to take an intro.
Well, why don't you get your favorite hanging on there? How about this one? You like this one?
Oh, yeah, that one's pretty.
That's pretty right there. Now, come here, let me show you something. I like the Blue Balls.
Nueve. Blue Balls NYCFC. Season 9.
I like the Blue Balls. The Blue Balls.
Nueve.
Blue Balls.
Season 9. Nueve.
Like that Australian fucking dog everybody loved so much before he got taken to the vet. Ladies and gentlemen, you've got blue balls. My name is Jake Beckard, and I am your intrepid co-host, and I am joined this week, as every week, except for last week, by my intrepid co-host, Mr. Trey Fillmore. Trey, do you watch Bluey?
No.
No? You've never watched even a clip that doesn't show
Why
up on your...
Why would I?
What? That's a question I have for a lot of people. There are a lot of people, and yet they do. Childless couples sit
watching
up at night.
Watching Bluey?
Yeah, dude.
Deranged.
They love it.
Put him on a list.
Trouble for you. I think that the overlap between Bluey enjoyers and Blue Balls enjoyers is probably pretty significant.
That's true. A lot of our listeners have kids now.
Or they don't, but they're the kind of childless people. They're the kind of fucking millennials, fucking Disney adults who watch anyway. Would be my guess. We have a lot of good-natured folks who just want to... Who I actually think it's an absolute overlap with. I think Bluey enjoyers and Ted Lasso enjoyers occupy...
That's not true.
No?
No?
No,
no, no. No.
Why not?
I say in shame. No, let's get off this whole Bluey shit, because I do have a story and how I'm doing right now that relates directly to your intro.
Okay, how are you doing today?
This is great. Okay. Well, my nose is a little stuffed up still because we still have the kitten. Yeah.
Yay.
Thought he would be gone by now.
You guys did not do your job. We said, we told you, reach out. We have a foster for you.
No,
get
no,
the
no.
Fuck on
they
it.
Are. People have reached out. And
oh,
one of
really?
Them made a fantastic joke that I'm going to share at the end of this. And it is the punchline to this whole story.
Now I'm excited.
So he was supposed to be gone on the 7th. We took him to the vet and they're like... He's a half a pound too little, way too underweight. But he's got to get those gains. He's got to put that weight on. And we're like, okay, next vet visit was the 20th. But on the 18th, he got a fucking sniffle, and they gave us medicine. And they're like, oh, he's on the medicine. He can't get the surgery. But it seems like the sniffles were from him kicking his fucking litter in his own face.
Uh-huh.
So that didn't happen. Finally, yesterday.
You got to get in there and show him how it's done.
Yom Kippur. We have an 8:50 a.m. vet appointment set up. Goodbye to Kitty. You know, he stayed 3 weeks longer than we wanted, but finally time to say goodbye, and he can get us forever home. We take him back, and they're like, hey, bad news. Can't neuter him today because one of his balls hasn't dropped yet. Fucking something with this cat. And so we can't keep him anymore because, like, I literally can't sleep without wheezing. Or anything, like, it's the worst. I mean, it's the cutest cat in the world. Like, seriously, a gem. The most beautiful little kitten. And the nicest, most affectionate cat. And I'm going to miss him so much. But we got to find him another foster in the next 2-3 days. And then he's going to wait 2 more weeks for his fucking nuts to hang. And then and then he'll be ready for adoption. And one of our listeners who was interested, who's been checking in with me about his status, I told him this story now about how he was supposed to be ready a fucking month ago. And he goes, wow, one of his balls didn't drop and now you can't get rid of him. That's a real Blue Balls podcast story. Like, how blue balls is that? One of his balls will not come.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyways, yep, I thought, so if you hear I'm nasally, perhaps more than usual, I should say. You know, I'm okay, though. I got my White Claw on deck. I got a Benadryl on deck. I got edible on deck. You know, this is what we call boy dinner.
You're loaded up. It sounds like that's like a photo I posted at Hurricane Sandy. That's a prep. That's a what's it called? A go bag. For a displacement experience.
I haven't done them yet. I'm about to do them all throughout the duration of this podcast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Stuff it down. What's your edible? What's your edible of choice?
The shitty ones you get from the store that make you feel like shit.
I still don't. It's been legal here for so long, and I still do. I mean, like, listen, I don't take edibles very often. Anyways, I'm a big Percy when it comes to weed. This has always been true. It took me a long time to admit it, and I smoked so much weed in high school and really pretended to enjoy it. And now I just, I take 1 5-milligram blueberry when I want to turn my brain off for the evening and not speak to anyone. But we don't buy in the city, even though it's legal or legal-ish, certainly available literally every fucking street corner, to say nothing of Williamsburg, which is lousy with weed stores. I still get them flown in from California. Whenever Serena goes home, she like goes to MedMen or whatever and picks up some of our favorites and brings them back because I know it works. I know it works, and I don't need dispensary, New York dispensary garbage. I'm not interested.
So bougie.
What can I say? I like what I like. I'm a bi-coastal bitch. And I eat tomatoes from the farm. I eat my edibles from the source. I go with the good shit, the organic shit. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't have anything. Go ahead.
Nah, me neither. That's it. The end. What's my boy dinner? My boy dinner is whiskey that's too good to be in flat ginger ale. In flat ginger ale. In a little cup. And I'm just nursing it. I'm going to be nursing it the whole... And
that's like old school blue balls.
I'm washing... I know it. I'm washing out the disgusting taste of Paxlovid from my mouth. Have you done the Paxlovid?
I've never had COVID, baby.
What?
Nope.
I'm sure you've told me this, and I'm sure you've told me this on mic, but I guess I hadn't realized or remembered. You've never had COVID?
Never.
You gotta be careful who you tell that. You can't put that on the airwaves, dude. They're gonna The Last of Us you, then break your friggin' brain open.
That's okay. I thought you... Oh, no, never mind. Just keep
what?
Going. Nothing. I thought about, what like, chasers or whatever.
Anyway, Paxlovid, it does this thing. This is the first time I took it because I'm working and I need to get the fuck back to work because I live in America and I can't help it. So I said, give me that Pax because it's going to speed it along and it's going to keep me from having lifelong debilitations, at least for now. And it gives you this taste in your mouth. It's not that it tastes bad. It doesn't taste bad like anything. It tastes like pills. But then, like, about 45 minutes after you take it, your mouth, your saliva starts to taste like the spine of lettuce. Do you know? Mm. It's this awful, like, bitter, like, acrid, bitter taste. And nothing that you do can get rid of it because it's in your saliva. So if you try to eat something delicious or, like, even just strong to overwhelm it, it works for a second, but then it makes you salivate more. And so you're once again flooded with this like disgusting, like borderline nauseating taste. It makes you feel sick or sicker than you actually are. All my other symptoms are gone. I'm testing negative. It's been 5 days. I'm chilling, you know, but I feel sick because I'm tasting doo-doo. That's 90% of the time I'm awake.
I relate because in two ways. One, that's what all this fucking hardcore allergy medicine is doing to me. And two, because I would get my bacon, egg, and cheese with lettuce because I'm a freak. And I would have the taste of that lettuce. Shit. I was like, I need a vegetable. give me some of that weird fucking shredded
5 day romaine, old shredded baby. Iceberg lettuce.
Iceberg.
Fuck me.
And it would stay in my mouth all day. Anyways, blah. Should we talk about soccer or not?
No. We don't have anything good to talk about, do we, Trey? Oh, wait. We do. Trey, 3 matches to recap as usual. A derby, highly disappointing. Followed by 2 unexpectedly optimistic matches, a 2-0 win over Orlando, and a 3-0 win over Toronto. What the fuck happened? All of a sudden we're in playoff contention, and it truly does. I mean, speak to... They wanted more teams in the playoffs? They got them, baby. No, we don't deserve to be in the playoffs. We don't deserve a berth, a postseason. We're not in the playoffs. Still might not happen for us. But that we are competitive after the season that we have had did they go too far in adding these 9 slots? What are we? I mean, you know, what are we doing here?
You know what's fun? The only reason we're in the playoffs, it goes exactly to what you're saying, is, and we're not in the playoffs, we're currently above the line, is that following the results of the last 3-4 games of the other teams that we have to beat is like the bottom of the East is like a bunch of fucking bumbling idiots. Like, no team wants to be in the fucking playoffs. Chicago, Charlotte, Red Bull, DC, like all of these people, and us until this past week, just tripping over their dick not to be in the playoffs. And it's only benefited us that all the results go our way. When we have a bad result, luckily other teams have lost or tied. Like, it keeps happening. And like, we haven't been facing the teams we need to beat, but now we will. So it's very interesting. Now all the bumbling has happened. There's only 3 games left to like really lock this shit down. It's such a weird place the bottom of the East is in this season. I haven't seen anything like it, but I haven't kept track because we've never been close.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's truly bizarre. And we ran into some, you know, like we got away with of course a notable exception, right? I mean, one of the teams at the bottom of the East is going to win the Open Cup, right? Like, there's that one of the teams at the bottom of the East has kind of a different relationship with all of this.
True, and we'll talk about.
We literally must. But yeah, no, it's the rest of it is, was it just a group mentality of rebuild season? I mean, how has a team like Toronto been so bad? Let's start there. For so long, for like so consistently bad. To be heading into the end of the season with a negative 24 fucking goal differential. Like, it's just an astonishingly poor record for a team that is no slouch, you know, generally. What's the upshot for this team that is certainly not going to sneak its way back into any kind of a contention?
Well, you see,
is mathematically eliminated. There's no, yeah. It's not close.
And we had the honors of mathematically eliminating them. It's that, you know, when you look at it's MLS 2.0 shit. It's a thing that doesn't fly anymore. It's if you spend a fuck ton of money on 2 players and they don't perform or they're injured for a majority of the season, you're screwed because you are allocating resources. Not only are you allocating resources to those, to Insigne and Bernardeschi, you are building your team around them. When they are good, you succeed. But when they aren't so good, you're fucked. And the cherry on top is like Michael Bradley, who we saw as the captain, was the captain against us. I was like, I forgot he was still playing. Like,
I know, me too.
And the way he played, he looked it. I mean, he looks 10 times slower than he ever was. They had him playing center back for half the match. It's embarrassing, and it sucks to see. Like, Toronto, who, when we started this podcast, we were watching MLS Cups, and they were in it. You know, this is a team that looked destined for some kind of sustained excellence and dynasty level success, like we see in Seattle on the other side. Lo and behold, you have a whole bunch of change up top, change in coaches, change in staffing, and some you have stars that you get and then they don't want to be there anymore or they're injured. I was shocked. Lorenzo Insigne made the trip. He was questionable, and I was like, I don't know why he came. Like, he wasn't going to play, but he was there. And it's just so weird to see that team so bad, but you have to believe at some point, like, they're going to retool and fucking gut the roster this offseason. I mean, who knows? If they can. If those guys, the 2 big tickets, want to re-up their contracts or want to stay, they're kind of screwed. I mean, I don't know what they're going to do. Because they do have good young players. So I just don't know what they're going to do. But they're awful. And we torched them. And good thing we did.
Yeah, thank God. I mean, in some ways, it was a demonstrate. It was exactly what you want out of that, right? Like they teed us up to be playing Toronto at this stage in this moment, in this, right? Like, especially following that Orlando match, is a sort of like, okay, can you actually keep your fucking shit together enough to put yourself in serious contention? Because otherwise, because we have literally put the ball on a tee in front of you, and if you cannot at least get a double out of this, or a triple as the case may be, then you don't deserve it. You don't deserve it whatsoever. But it wasn't just that. It wasn't a by rote thing. It wasn't just exploiting weaknesses. It was also a lot of pieces connecting. This was not an ugly match. And I think that's what I was afraid of following the Red Bulls game. I have to pull up, not to pull us all the way back, but I have to pull up, like, let's talk about the Red Bulls so that we don't have to talk long about the Red Bulls. But I do you remember that gala that you came to and for the show that you helped so generously to support? No, you didn't come to. You just supported from afar. You did. Yes. You did. I didn't go. That's what I thought.
All right, I did not go.
Thank you for reminding me. It was one of the silent auction prizes was tickets to the Red Bulls game. This was back in June, maybe even May. So who knew where we were going to be? Dear friends of mine, Matt and Tara, just recently married. I'm a big fans of them, of their relationship. Incredibly supportive. They really wanted these tickets. They're not MLS people, but they're like, well, maybe I'll get into it. Like, I'm excited about it. And I know that Jake does this podcast and blah, 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 blah. And
oh, they no. really...
They ginned it up. I mean, like, they paid, I think, ultimately, like, $240 for a pair of tickets to this match.
Jesus Christ.
I said, did you guys go? Did you have fun? Did you enjoy the thrilling nil-nil soccer of two teams with no hope for the playoffs? And Matt said, Jake, it was both better and worse than I expected. On the one hand, it was better in terms of the view in the stadium. I didn't mind. The turf covering the infield was comedy, but still. I thought it was cute and intimate. I said, cute and intimate. Tara said, dude, they play so badly, though. It was maybe a little hard to watch.
Yeah.
The soccer was messy, and the ref had no control over the game.
Yeah.
And then Matt said, we love the excuse to get out of the house. But that's what it was. That's what it was end to end, right? There was nothing from anybody. It was the most anodyne soccer. It was the worst, frankly, the worst way that you could have introduced a couple of people to NYCFC, to MLS, to this rivalry. It was so profoundly out of character, frankly. So what was it? What was the lead weight in everybody's pants on this match? Was it just a kind of a despondency?
I think, frankly, I think it just comes down to, you know, I noticed from both sides, and it was probably the first time where, you know, the Red Bull press always come to the press box and whatever, and like it's always kind of antagonistic. I mean, there's always some, you know, it's a rivalry, so it that stretches to every aspect of the game. But this was the first time where I didn't feel any. After the game, we were just talking to Red Bull press people being like, hey, that sucked, didn't it? Like, yeah, that was stupid. Like, what an awful match. It was just a lot of, I don't know, badness. But I think the biggest thing is, like, Red Bulls, and we talked about this, like, Red Bulls will drag you down to their level. That's how they win games. That's how they play well. And that's what they've always done. And the biggest key is to not make a stupid mistake and let them score and weather their bad play and then try to hit them back. But by the end of the match, like, the Rebels drag you down to their level, and their level at this point was, like, not caring and not being good. So NYCFC themselves not being the best team in that moment also did the same. And, you know, it was just an emotional kind of dead weight that both teams were carrying. And, you know, I think capped off, and the most important thing was the Keaton Parks injury, you know, was him going down and just being in so much pain that we've never seen him before. For a guy who has played almost every minute of every match this season, a fucking medical miracle, given that no professional player ever has come back from two blood clot surgeries. And I think that really dampened the match. I mean, most importantly, we were playing with three, essentially, defensive midfielders in the midfield throughout the game. And this was on the heels of Maxi Morales leaving. So, like, all those things, like, there was just such a fucking negative energy in the middle of the pitch. No teams, like, the Rebels press guy I was talking to, he's like, this team just forgot how to play through the midfield. And I was like, yeah, and my team forgot to build a midfield. There was just nothing on either end going through the middle, and you could feel it. Like, both defenses did well. I think we had some good chances, but nothing was going to go in because they also are a good defensive team. Like, they're aggressive to the point of attack. So that's just what the game felt like, and it was a real, real fucking boondoggle. And the funny thing is that, you know, I was talking to a New York City front office member after the match, and they were telling me that the numbers, their analytics were like, we could still be in a good position to make the playoffs if we had 7 points from this week from Red Bull, Orlando, and Toronto. And that's what they expected. But then tying Red Bull, he was like, oh, I don't know if we're going to hit those 7 points. Little did he know we were going to fucking blast Orlando midweek. Little did anyone know. Yeah. But it had that feeling because the playoffs are still in the focal point. You know, the season, the only thing left in this season is, can you make the playoffs? It's the only thing we can scrape from this season and feel good outside of the performance of all the newbies, which has been a wonderful surprise. But that was my main takeaway from the game. It was just a fucking mud fight. It was a fucking, I called it an idiot fight. It was all of that and more. And it sucked, and we shouldn't talk about it anymore because we have too much to talk about.
Great. Let's leave it all behind. Let's leave it all behind. There's so much else to talk about. The midweek blasting of Orlando is, I think, the easiest thing to go straight to. But I also want to chat briefly about, I think there was a non-zero amount of hope that we might see Keaton Parks this weekend. We did not, but what are you hearing through the grapevine?
That he looks, it's definitely, you know, they tested for the high ankle sprain, and it wasn't that, and it was just a normal ankle sprain. So we've seen him the last two games walking around, and he has no limp or anything whatsoever. Now, I don't know if he'll play against Miami. He might make the bench. That might be bullshit, too. I think they're just going to save him because Miami, like, all things considered, we don't know if Messi's going to play or not. We don't know if Jordi Alba's going to play, whatever. Like, it could be a game that we could sacrifice not having Keaton Parks for the sake of his ankle. And if that's the case, then we would do that and then see where we go from there. And I think that's going to be the decision point. Like, I could see him playing two games at the end of the season. I just don't know if one of those is Miami.
Do you feel like... I mean, well, we'll get to that later. We'll save the question of Miami for when we talk about Miami proper. It would be nice. It would be exciting. It'd be good. It's a relief because I think we all saw Parks go down and thought, oh, another one. That's it. Season's over. Bing, bang, boom. Whatever. Which is miserable, especially for a guy like Keaton, who is, like, obviously no stranger to injury and suffering and outage before, and also is the heartbeat of the team. Anytime that he's on the field, it opens up a million more options when he's playing. It like you said, I think there's a ton of strategy in terms of how you play the recovery from that injury in the next three matches, and it goes hand in hand with everything else about how you try to ensure that you stay above the line here. It's a real nail. It's fun. It's nice at least to have something to, like, bite one's nails about, you know, and to feel like we are in control of what's happening, at least in part. But there's no reasonable way that we should go into, even against, you know, Miami, DC, and Chicago, we can't go into these matches thinking, like, oh, we've got this locked up or shit's on our side. It's not necessarily anyways. Moving back to, I think, the more interesting, more exciting thing that you've already name-dropped, Trey. We've had a huge showing out from new talent. We've had a huge showing out from old talent that we have been hoping to see flash, right, like hot returns for. Can we jump straight to Talish Magno's
return to good graces or something resembling good graces, a goal against Orlando, two assists against Toronto. Is Magno back? And if he is, why?
Yeah, isn't it crazy? Like, really put on the back burner, not seeing time. And I think it's really interesting that, like, as it, you know, with Muncef Bakrar coming into the team and being so successful at changing the dynamic of the team itself, it really left a huge question as to what Magno was going to be going forward, and where he was going to play and if he was going to crack the starting 11, because going into the Red Bull game, it was Pellegrini was the lockdown starter for one reason or another. But that was the Magno game. You know, he's a kid. He's still a kid. He's still a young player. He is a guy that does, in fact, work his ass off all the time. He was just not performing well. He just didn't understand kind of the stakes and the... You know, this might be the first time in his career that he's been benched or has been performing poorly. Like, it is hard for a young player to go through that. And I like the fact that even though he has been playing well, a majority of fans still understand that there is a base level of talent that is unequal to any other player we've ever had. I mean, the talent that this kid has is astronomical, but how it fits on the field for this team has not been evident this season. You know, primarily because he was playing out of position and asked to do things he can't do, and secondly because he wasn't playing next to Tata Castellanos. So there's real question marks. And finally, we got the opportunity midweek in Orlando. You know, Richie Ledesma gets an injury after spitting on someone that it was the moment, because Pellegrini was suspended for that match due to yellow card accumulation, this was the time he could make a difference. And not 9 minutes after he was subbed on in this match, 9 minutes of, by the way, fantastic combination play with Muncef Bakrar. He had one opportunity that was like a beautiful body fake, and then he fucking pillow-footed the shot because he... just lost control of his body like a baby deer. And a lot of people were pissed at that, of course. But even that, him working in combination with Bakrar and the natural ability to use that body feint, like, those are the good things you look for. It's just the result wasn't there. Then the cross comes in from Jason and he fucking heads it in and he breaks down in tears and we get it. And he's like, you know, after the match, he's a fucking changed man. He's happy. He's the good old Talis Magno we've missed. And I think it's humongous. I think it was a big game for him. It earned him the start against Toronto, a team that he would have the opportunity to fucking dance all over, and he did. And we'll talk about Toronto, but just like the things, you could see he's a different player. Like, he valued the defensive aspect of the ball. He understood his ability on the ball is much more valuable working in space and then passing, as opposed to trying to take people one-on-one. Like, that is the biggest change that we saw in Toronto. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, in Toronto he did have bad moments dribbling the ball and trying to beat people. But defensively, that was the best we've ever seen him, and something that this team values. And his ability in space in Toronto, but also in the Orlando game, there's a little bit more space to work with. It was so great to see him kind of understand the difference. Now, these are just two games, and I mean, less than 120 minutes or so. So, you know, the jury's still out, of course, of basically about everything we're talking about. But it was the Talis Magno game. It was the game we saw him work with Bakrar for the first time. It worked. It was the game where he got his confidence back. It was the game where he scored the goal, and it was fantastic.
Do you think, how does that come about? I mean, like, does that come from being cowed for all of these matches? Like, from riding the bench, from being, I don't know, told in explicit or implicit terms, like, you ain't shit until you understand how you work inside of a team? Or is it like a maturity that's like been being gently developed in play, in practice, in all of those things, and like just finally found an opportunity to be executed when you had players who were available to be responsive to him, when you have a back rock connection that is that is matured rather than just being a sort of like right fresh off the boat right into the lineup relationship.
I think the benching might have been good for him. I think it is a moment where he understood that he wasn't doing well enough and needed to earn his place. And from what I've been hearing, he's been lighting up in practice. And, you know, I think in these moments, it's important to have a coach like Kleberson, someone who can translate and talk directly to him. Kleberson's not like necessarily a personality match. He's not like a loud, boisterous kind of disciplinarian. But he himself, as a player, was someone who did the dirty work and was not the flashiest of players and earned his way up because of his utility to, you know, he got the opportunity in the World Cup of 2002 and became a linchpin of that team. And it's that kind of attitude that I think is important for Talish Magno to have. Like, you are a better player if you work in service of the team than yourself. And young players don't necessarily understand that. And that's been the theme of this
particularly
team this
young
season.
Players like Magno who have been feted early. You know what I mean? Who, mm-hmm. Right, like, what's his trajectory? Oh, he's got a lot of promise, but he shits the bed somewhere else. He comes to New York, a league that is, you know, much maligned in other places, expecting probably to be able to, like, dance circles around people, briefly does dance circles around people, shows some flash, gets some approval for it, and then continues not to, like, see his team go anywhere or his own actions go anywhere, is put in a position... Like, he is given the chance, is put in a position, is made the number nine... like stopgap or no, and like asked, okay, great, you're hot shit, score goals, fails to score goals. It in a way, it's like, how could you do anything else at this point after having learned all of that, right? Like, you've been celebrated for your potential for so long, but clearly you don't know what that actually means because you haven't applied it to the team. You've only applied it to yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about, in general, the Orlando game. Like, how do we beat the number two team in the East, who's coming off a hot streak? I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, I think Bakar's being a much more facilitated into this team. I think his ability to stretch the field is so valuable, and he had some great, you know, Nick Cushing mentioned his need to develop the other side of his game, not the running behind Bakrar that he's so used to playing, but the back to a defender trying to bully them. Like, he did one or two moments in that game so well. Like, if they're going to try to play the high line, we'll punish them. And that's what we did. And I think that was a big part. I think Richie Ledesma actually did a good job of having the intensity in the press that is necessary for this team. Obviously, this team is not pressing as much as they ever have ever, but there is still a necessity for a team that doesn't want to press as much but still wants to have a high back line and high possession to have an intensity up front. And I think Richie helped with that. And we can't talk any... We can't go any farther without talking about Mr. Star on the Rise, Brunch himself, Andres Jason.
I've never seen a player on this team who more got that dog in him.
Guess what? You fucking nailed it last podcast, by the way. I was thinking about it, and you were spot on about the psychological profile that it takes to have these kinds of performances, and he just built on that. The idea of, like, sitting and waiting your time to understand, like, maybe I'm not the most physically talented or technically talented, but I'll fucking work, and I'm smart, and I know that I can play these games. And if the moment comes, I'm going to fucking pull out everything from my bag, and he's showing us things he's never shown before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very sports anime, Trey. It's very Kuroko's Basketball. You know what I mean? Like, that's why all of my analysis comes from sports anime tropes. And Jason is definitionally that kind of, like, stock character. There's always one. in these shows where there's just like a dude, there's a dude who is watching, right? Like the protagonist is like superhuman and just keeps on sort of like finding ways to like escalate their superhuman qualities. Their journey is like a Tati Castellanos journey, where it's like they know that they're special, and then they get special, and then they get specialer and specialer, and they like always pull it out. But the show gets bored with that pretty quickly, and then it becomes, right, like it sidebars with like all of the other players on the court or the field or whatever, and one of them is always someone who knows they're not as good. Like that their talent is simply like not their raw talent will never equal the like superhuman players who are dazzling in this show, but they want to. They see it and they want to be a part of it, and they're like, all I can do is just fucking show up and throw down, and I take both solace in that, and I like win the game. Right, like I am ultimately the difference maker, because it does come down to will, and dude has will for days and shows. It's gorgeous. I mean, like, talk to us about the particulars. Talk to us about the nitty gritty. What did you see from Jason that you'd never seen before?
I think the two biggest things are his confidence one on one, his ability to beat players off the ball. It's not something we've ever seen from him, but if you look at the goals he scored and you look at the opportunities he set up, he's not scared when he's face up with a defender of trying to make a play. And that's what has led to many opportunities we've had. And secondly, his ability to cross the ball, his willingness to cross the ball. I mean, that's something in Orlando we did extremely well. And he just, I mean, obviously the Talish Magno goal, you know, he himself said like he didn't put the ball where he wanted to on that play, but because Talish is so fucking strong, tall, and he said Talish has a strong neck, which I thought was weird. Like, yeah, Talish, he gives good neck. His ability to whip the ball in is like, you know, something that we haven't had from that side of the field in a long time. You know, we're playing, he's a right-footed player on the right side of the field. It's, is he right? God, he's done so much with his left. I'm starting to question myself. I don't know. But he is, in any case, ambidextrous. And those two things really stood out to me the most. And like, he has some good top-line speed. Like, if we want to play over the top because we have Bakar and there's space there, he can also chase down balls too. So all those things together, I think. And his, you mentioned, like, his confidence. Like, that's what taking players one-on-one is. You know, he's not afraid. Halfway through the season, we were saying the only player who's not afraid in the attacking third is GP. And now we have someone like Jason, who's not afraid in the final third. And that's refreshing. Mm-hmm. Another fucking standout who's been fantastic in the last two games is Andres Perea, of course. Mm-hmm, Keaton Maxi Morales goes down. Keaton Parks goes down. What the fuck are we going to do? Well, you know, friend of the pod, Alec of Five Borough Footy, I was sitting next to him in the Orlando game, and he, as the game was starting, he's like, you notice how good Perea's been in set pieces? I was like, no, I don't, that hasn't stuck out to me. But in that match, like, the ball always found his head. Just someone who's just a dog, who is always, I mean, he has an attacking dimension. He's such a fucking versatile player. Like, he has the engine and the acceleration and the defensive acumen to make those, you know, breakaway tackles that he needs to, but he's been so well acclimated in the orbit of our attacking play that he'll fucking take a shot if he needs to. He'll, you know, he finally got his goal against Toronto, but just having that presence is the utility that we need without Maxi Morales and Keaton Parks on the field. And
yeah, he's a threat, but he also has like real passing intelligence, which is very exciting. And it absolutely makes you wonder where this motherfucker has been and why Philly like couldn't make anything.
That's the craziest thing. Because he was so good in Orlando, and that's why Philly bought him, and that's why we paid Philly so much for him. It's just that Philly, they just love fucking Choo Choo Bueno so much. That they love their young kids so much that if you fall behind a starter, if you're if you're competing for a starting spot in Philly and you fall behind the starter, you're not just second in line. You've now become fourth in line, because any position they have that a starter, if a starter is subbed out or gets injured, they're going to give it to a kid, because that's how they develop talent so well. And so it left him on the back burner. And I obviously, like, a resounding yes to, we need this guy on the fucking field at all times, you know, going for, we need to fucking send Philly a bag. I don't care how big the bag is for this, for Andres, because he's also like a fantastic personality. He's a good person to have on your team. You know, but between the whistles, he's a dog. And outside of the whistles, he's a refreshing personality to have around. And an MLS veteran, which we know you need MLS veterans to win in this league.
Yes.
So, he's been absolutely phenomenal.
Who else? Is there anything else to talk about on the Orlando side of things?
The only thing in the Orlando thing that is interesting, of course, is something that was not on the broadcast, is the Santi and Bakrar fight for the penalty, which I think is very interesting. It showed a side of Bakrar that we have not seen, that now makes me look at him in a different light. He is a competitor. He is a fucking... He's very, like, soft-spoken and shy and whatever, but he wants to score goals. Like, that striker mentality of, like, no, it's me time is, like, that was very evident. And it was, like, there's a knife's edge in these moments between good morale for the team and fucking awful, like, this can't happen on a professional team. I think back to when Kai Kamara was on the Columbus Crew and essentially, like, booked his own ticket out of that team because he was fighting. Literally, they got in a shoving match over a penalty. And it didn't get to that level, which is good. So it was kind of good to see. Like, Santi was like, bro, I earned the penalty. I've been on this team for years. This is my penalty. And Bakrar was holding the ball behind his back. Like, no, little man, I'm the fucking nine. I'm taking this penalty. So much so that Santi had to go and get another ball. And Richie Ledesma had to come in and be like, hey, coach says it's Santi. Because he was coming from the bench. And then that carried over, of course, into the Toronto game, where Bakrar was the only player who did not go to the bench during the VAR check and stayed at the spot to ensure that he was going to get that penalty, which he earned. So I'm okay with it. But it just shows kind of like, I'm not concerned. Like, Santi is, we know that Santi is that player. And now we see that Bakrar is also that player. So as long as those two guys get along, we'll, you know, and can sort it out in those kind of tense moments, then it's a benefit, but it's close to being a bad thing.
Yeah, you're hedging. Is it a pro? I like pro con. I feel like I'll situate it entirely in the benefit zone. That's what I want. I want a striker who wants goals.
Yeah. You know. No, I like it. A
striker who's fucking who's thirsty for it. I have enough. Like, team players are great, and I haven't seen enough from Bakrar. It's not like he's a shit presence, right? Like, maybe it gets worse later on. I don't know. Probably there's like pecking order shit that has to happen. But if I've got somebody who has a nose for goal, who will, like, go hard to get that goal, like, when things are paused, you know that motherfucker is going to go hard to get that goal when between whistles, as you said.
Yeah.
It's why we hired him. I guarantee you. That hunger, and that hunger is, like, inarguable, is why we hired him.
Mm-hmm. Toronto, is there anything? We almost already talked about the whole Toronto game. Super interesting thing about the Toronto game. Obviously, we killed and they suck, and that was perhaps the most evident. Talish Magno and Bakrar starting together. I think Bakrar was gassed. He did not have a good match. He missed the penalty, obviously. And that's okay. Like, he was running on his third full game. He himself admitted last week that he was not full game shape, and we were trying to play him 90 for three straight games at halftime. Yeah. At a halftime, Cushing took him out. I think it was the right decision. That game, we were winning 2-0. It didn't seem in danger.
Yeah, literally.
Give him some rest. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that in the first half, the dynamic that he adds that has made this team so good, you know, stretching the field, being a target, always being in the box and finding the right places, creating good chances, allowing Santi to be more flexible, allowing our wingers to work with him. Like, all that's good. Even when he's having a bad game, we were winning 2-0. And then you take him off. Most interesting to me, we take him off, and the whole Talish Magno, does Cushing see him as a striker thing, was answered, because when Bakrar came off, Santi played the false nine. Completely different ethos, completely different energy around how they played offense without Bakrar on the field, and yet it was still extremely successful, and I thought that was really interesting and cool to see. Like, Santi as a false nine is something we haven't seen since Dallas, and he played it so interestingly. Like, his willingness to drop down and receive outlet passes from defenders, obviously not something we asked Bakrar to do, but it worked so well to keep the ball moving. And then you have Talish Magno as the 10, which we've never seen him before. And that worked well because he got to work with Julian Fernandez in combination, overloading the wing. Because
there's the segue.
Having two kind of like-minded wingers working in combination with each other, not 10 feet apart from each other, was so fucking good to see. It was so electrifying and interesting. And those two guys just love fucking... Their natural talent just explodes out of them. And like, Talish Magno had a fake pass dummy that was so awesome, and it worked. And it was like that moment, I was like, oh my God, I'm having fun watching this team again. It was so weird and so beautiful. And of course, Julian Fernandez is as good as we thought he would be. He is so fucking good. He is so naturally talented in all the ways you want a creative winger to be, and let alone his magical finish that he had for his first goal.
Yeah, gorgeous. Just gorgeous. And not just the finish, but the build-up, and not just the build-up, but the assist. You're exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that they are liberating each other because they know what each other can do.
Yeah,
you know, like there's a sensitivity to, like, there's almost that thing of like, sometimes when you click with somebody, you're like, go do that thing that I would do, right? Like, go do that, like, go be a little extension of me, or like, go do something good, go do something fucked up on him. You know, like, you see, the confidence feeds the confidence, and there's a kind, right? Like, there's an authorization or an encouragement or whatever, right? Like, it's not doubted or second doubted. That same, like, that seamlessness becomes a handed off seamlessness, because that's the thing that both of them have when they're at their best. They have that, like, seamless energy and attention, right? Like no, there's no double checking. And I think that that's a thing that we've seen fuck Talish Magno a million times in one-on-ones, but in combination, all of a sudden, right, like, there's it's rewarded and beautifully. It's just such a fun goal to watch and rewatch.
Yeah, and that started with Talish Magno navigating the space between three defenders and not trying to dribble past them, but using his wing back, using, you know, which allowed, you know, when he made the pass back, it allowed Julian to lose his man. Like, these are all, when you make a pass in soccer, you're not just affecting the person you're passing to and the defenders around you. You're affecting other players on the field as well. And like that was so good to see. What else is there?
We got to talk about Matt Fries.
We do, oh, dude, there's so much to talk about. Matt Fries.
Yeah, let's talk about Matt Fries. Three clean sheets.
I got some numbers for you. Hold on. I said that before having them readily available. Let's see if I can do it.
I wrote down freestyle love supreme.
Great.
Which is only for some people.
Post shot expected goal. You know, there's no good goalkeeper analytic. You kind of have to take the body of work and context, because there's also good defenses and quality of shots and whatever. And quality of shots is... Post shot expected goals before the Cincinnati match, before and including the Cincinnati match, is per 90 a -0.12. So it's okay, pretty healthily below zero. Pretty healthily below benefit. Not good. Post shot expected goals.
Hold on. You have to explain that one more time, or maybe a little bit more slowly, okay. Or maybe a little bit more in detail.
Post shot expected goals plus minus is actually the full name of the stat, and it's basically like given the quality of the shot after it left the boot of a person. Like expected goals covers all quality of all chances, even shots that don't hit the target. Post shot expected goal plus minus is how many goals are expected from a shot on target against how many goals were scored. So a negative means you're letting in more goals than expected that are on target, and a positive means you're saving more goals than expected for shots on target.
Okay. So, you're welcome, fan base.
So a negative 0.12 is bad. I mean, it's negative. It means that the goalkeeping performances have been a hindrance to the team in terms of expectation, right?
But by an incredibly thin margin.
Yeah, not... I mean, it's not incredibly thin, but it's not drastic. But it's not good. Like, you need to have a neutral or positive amount if you want to be a winning team. And then since the Cincinnati game, the last five games... it's fucking 0.46, which is amazing, which is what you want, which is, I think a lot of that is the save against the Red Bulls. Those numbers are in context of our defense has been great. Berkerisa and Tiago Martins have been getting better and better every game, especially since Cincinnati. You know, it's marked improvement. And that helps. So he hasn't had to face too many shots, but he is doing a fantastic job in the hard saves that he has to make. And that's it, right? If you have a really good defense, you need a goalkeeper that will step up in those shots that are right in front of the fucking goal that slipped through somehow, and you need him to make a save. And in the last five games, he has been, and he has earned that number one spot, and we thank him for it. It's good to see him really do a good job. I mean, it puts him... What's funny is, like, there are 10 keepers in this league that are really good this season, which means 20 are bad. And, you know, the post shot expected goal plus minus is not 50-50. You know, there's 10 really good goalkeepers in this league. And he technically would still be, I think, just outside. But he's in the obviously, he's in the positive. He's 0.46 per 90. That's like, I mean, that's a phenomenal number. He's just... He's cooking.
Yeah, he's having an extraordinary run of form, and it's at exactly the moment that we need him to.
Yeah, he's got to keep going. You know who else is having a good run of form?
Do it.
Tavon Gray is having a good run of form. He's hit that ceiling that we kind of all knew since 2021. You know, where luckily, if you have enough people performing in front of you, like an Andres Jason or Julian Fernandez, like, you don't have to be responsible for doing those things, which lets him shine in a way that is really satisfying. Like, his ability defensively, you know, someone joked, I forgot who it was, that, like, is Tavon Gray our best one-on-one defender? Like, he might be. And just him, the amount of confidence he's had since his call-up to Jamaica is great. I mean, I think he understands, like, the adultness of, like, being a professional in terms of, like, oh, there are things involved, like international play and legacy and, you know, status within a starting 11. And you have a 18-year-old the team spent $1 million on who is much better offensively than you. Like, what are you going to do? And I think he understands the context of all those things. Been really impressed by his play, let alone, like, his ability... as someone who's been in the locker room longer than 90% of the players and is the positive emotional force that your team needs when games like Red Bull happen, when a season like this season happens, you need a fucking cheerleader to keep people up. And, like, his relationship with Talish is fantastic. His relationship with, you know, all the players is so good. He's just someone that loves to joke around and keeps things positive, which is And on the field, he's obviously like, he's a dog. He's a fighter. He won't back down. He doesn't care. He's gotten suspended for talking shit. So he's not afraid of the nonsense either.
It feels good to see Tavon get not just support from, or not just recognition for like consistently like solid performances, not just like make visible impacts on the game, but also just like get the, I don't know, the aplomb from the fans that is long overdue him as well. Tavon is showing up. Tavon is a cheerleader. Tavon is like good fucking mojo end to end to end. And I just feel like that's only translated into good play in this last week.
Yep.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I would say the only other thing I had on my list, but I don't want to talk about it because I think the data is incomplete right now, is Kevin O'Toole getting a lot of minutes recently.
Yeah.
Jury's still out. I don't really know why or how or whatever. I think he's doing fine enough. He's not bringing the team down whatsoever. He's shown some flashes offensively. I don't know if it's, you know, Nick Cushing mentioned this past week about how at this time last year is when they solidified the starting 11 that they then had that good run into the playoffs with. Mm. And Kevin O'Toole was part of that. And I wonder if Nick Cushing kind of trusts him in these as a high floor player who understands the stakes of the playoffs. I don't know. It's not, but
there's
it's
a weird version of it that's not quite good luck charm, but it's related.
It's weird because Brian Kufre, I don't think, has done anything to lose a starting job. That's the only interesting, at least on the field. I don't know. It's weird. Jury's still out. Incomplete data.
I thought it might be interesting to talk. I mean, if we had more time, we could talk maybe a little bit about Chiago Martins and Burke Risa in the back. And I think, like, which I think has been, I won't say, like, revelatory, but certainly remarkable.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Like, it's a stronger than expected defensive situation for something that we thought was kind of getting gut shot over the course of the, particularly losing Maxime. We've looked a lot less shaky than expected. Given that, like, arguably, you know, one of the best defenders in MLS left us midseason. And that's because this pairing, which is a, don't forget, brand new pairing, has mm-hmm. been outperforming what I think anybody had reasonable expectations of.
I believe so. And also, like, the fact that Tiago Martins has now worn the captain's armband all these games, mm-hmm. and also that I tweeted out when I saw, like, CJ Sapong walked up and gave Burke Risa a fucking fist bump.
Yeah.
That is not nothing. To get the respect of a MLS fucking seasoned veteran, you know, to get his respect is not nothing.
No, it certainly is not, Trey. You know what else is not nothing?
What?
Playing Inter Miami this weekend in a situation where they have two games in pocket and are reasonably the most likely team. Well, not the most likely. I don't know. It's all over the place. But are one of the teams that with an excellent shot of knocking us out of our playoff berth. Is this game a must win for us? Not because of the points, but because of the opposition?
You know, in a vacuum, in a messy, less vacuum, you can see a team who is so much better than they were before Messi and a team that would be easy points that is suddenly not easy points. All the good things we just said for the last 50 minutes have to be couched with we were playing at home and some of the teams we faced weren't that good. So if you couch that, this does become a must win because it's all this good mojo we've just built up in the last week. Now's the time to test it because the last two games, if you even win but don't look good, or let me say if you tie and look like shit, those last two games don't mean anything. You have zero chance. You have to set the standard. Away play for this team this season has been god-awful, and you need to set the standard now. because you have another road game right after it. And this team being at home for so long, I think it's interesting to face a test like this. Of course, the other side of the context is that Inter Miami is playing in the U.S. Open Cup final the night this podcast drops. How hard are they going to go? Is that going to be an extra time? They have a bunch of injuries they're dealing with. How are they managing? That's the biggest question, is the injuries. Of course, because we come to Lionel Messi. Let me tell you, Jake. Lionel Messi came. Still hard to believe. I watched every one of their... what the fuck was that? Leagues Cup matches. And I have never had so much fun watching an MLS team, ever. It was so fun. It's a spectacle. It is an event. It is, you feel the history on the field as it's happening. You see the combinations of Messi and Busquets and Alba. You see the elevation of players like Kramaski or Robert Taylor, who... before Messi came, was a fucking joke of an MLS player. No offense to him, because he's turned it around, but did not deserve to see an MLS field. Is now a dangerous winger in this league. You know, Joseph Martinez has kind of been a wet fart for them, and now you have Campana, who they just signed to an extension, who is a terrifying striker. The way that this team has gelled around, not just Messi, who, of course, adding the best player of all time to your team will make you better, not months after he won the World Cup single-handedly almost. Not even that, but just like his gravity and how he elevates his players around him is the most dangerous part of this team. And that's what we have to look out for. And it's weird that we don't know if we're going to see Messi or not. He's missed the last two games. He came out injured in one of them. He's been on and off since the League's Cup. Now in the U.S. Open Cup, they're saying Messi's going to be kind of a game-time decision, but he did practice. We don't know, because I think they want to win that cup a lot, because I do think that they aren't convinced of their playoff odds, and I think they've said as much. If Messi does play in that match, does he turn around 4 days later, coming off an injury and playing in this cup game, does he play against us? Because let me tell you, it sucks to try to preview a game when you don't know whether or not the greatest player of all time will be on the field. Jordi Alba is not playing in the cup final. I don't know if that means he's going to play Saturday. Maybe we won't see Messi, but we'll see Jordi Alba. But of course, the biggest thing, and I think it's hilarious how understated this signing became in the midst of all of this, is fucking Busquets. One of the greatest sixes of all time. One of the greatest midfielders of the last 20 years. Who just kind of came, and during Messi's announcement, they're like, hey, we're going to take 5 minutes and tell people that Busquets is also here. Very, just kind of explains kind of the nature of his game. Like the understated nature of being such a creative six. I mean, just imagine Keaton Parks on fucking steroids. I mean, this guy is infallible. Not just on steroids. I mean, like, 100 times better. This guy is going to be a fucking mess. And I think we need to, messy or not, we need to dominate possession, dominate the midfield through our pressure. I mean, it's going to be, the midfield is the key to them. Because, like, once they get the ball, you know, if they can get the ball to their wings, not like, they're not the most effective team building from the wings, but if they get the ball past midfield, every avenue is open to them. Kramaski or Robert Taylor or any one of their forwards or Messi lurking around the box or Yedlin is going to be out, thank fuck. Because like the amount of weapons they can fill the entire final third once Busquets or Messi has the ball past halfway line is terrifying. It's the most terrifying offense past midfield of any team in MLS, just because of what those two guys can do from the midfield. That's going to be the biggest thing. The most important player in this match, probably, or the two of them, are going to be Perea and James Sands. Like, can James Sands take on Messi? Or, if that's not the question, can Perea frustrate Busquets? And we know he has the dog in him, and thank God he does, because he's going to need it in this match. Because that's the key. Because everything else on this team is working. It is. For the first time this season, like, this team is functioning at all three levels. Four levels. Because Matt Freese is doing well. So, now that you're... You just have to treat this game like it's the Orlando game, where you have to say, their midfield's good, we have to fucking dominate possession and press well and keep them from getting the ball there. And it's just the same thing again.
Yeah, it seems so much to have to do with, right, like, with retaining enough control that you can preserve your ability to be creative, right? Like, that yeah. and if you can't, then if you don't have the one, then you won't have the other. It will be easy to get demoralized playing this team, and resisting that and holding on to all of the positive mojo that has been built up over the last week and the last 7 points is the only way to pull it off. I will disagree with one thing, which is that I don't think that it's a must win. I think a draw with good play is enough to it's not ideal, but it preserves the lifeline.
If Charlotte does poorly, yes. Like, that leaves a lot on other people's plates, is the unfortunate reality. I mean, it's like technically a must-win in that sense, that you don't want to have to rely on Charlotte shitting the bed.
Right.
But I get what you're saying. It's our toughest game out of the last three, clearly.
What's your scoreline?
We're going to win, bitch, 2-0.
Does Messi play?
I'm kind of scared that he will.
Mm-hmm.
I'm scared that he will. I was really confident he wouldn't. But the fact that he's so questionable for the cup match makes me think that, oh no, then he's getting better for the playoff match. I was hoping he was healthy enough for the cup match to go full throttle so that he could rest Saturday.
But yeah, I don't know if that's gonna happen. Yeah, it doesn't seem like that, maybe. Okay, so a 2-win against Messi. Or 2-0 win against Messi.
Okay, 2-1. Give him Messi one. God, I'm fucking terrified.
At home. Away in Miami. Okay, great. Sounds good. I'll co-sign. 2-1. Easy. Easy peasy. Snap it up.
Last final cherry on top of this episode is that I tweeted out that Julian Fernandez is like, his player comp is Britney Spears Dancing with Knives. And a team employee messaged me and said, he's more like Angel Di Maria running down an escalator. I like that.
Good insider stuff. Trey, where do you tweet at?
Trey Fillmore, what about you?
At Jake Beckhardt, and you can find us both at Blue Balls Pod. All the links are in the link tree that's in our Twitter bio, our X bio, and that's pretty much all that you need to know. If you want to drop a dollar in the tip jar, we'd very much appreciate it. Help us keep the lights on. This shit ain't free. You can give us money at the tip jar, or you can buy merch from us. It's cozy season. Get cozy with a Blue Balls sweater. Wouldn't that be fun? A nice, thick, fuzzy Blue Balls sweater to take you into pumpkin spice season. Thank you so much for listening yet again to an episode of Blue Balls. We will see you on the other side of Miami, hoping for good results. It's not over yet, baby. Drive on through. We're balling hard all the way through October 21st. We'll see you then. Bye.
Bye.